Welcome back to Brain Biohacking with your host, Kayla Barnes. We dive into all things optimal health, optimal brain health, nutrition, peak performance, cognitive excellence, biohacking, longevity, and so much more.
Hannah, it is a pleasure to have you today on my podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Kayla. I'm excited to chat.
Absolutely. I mean, I can't wait to talk all things biological age. I mean, biological age has just really, truly blown up like over the course of the last few years, and it's amazing. So I've been familiar with True Diagnostics, you know, your company, for many years. I did my first test many years ago, but I'm really excited. I'm actually going to enter the Rejuvenation Olympics. So I'm excited. I just sent in my next test today. So I dropped it off. You guys should be getting it soon. So excited to talk about all things biological age.
Yeah, me as well. Biological age, I would say, is definitely that big new sexy topic. You see it everywhere on social media. It's like you turn your head and you see even a billboard for it. But there's many ways to measure it, which I'm sure we'll get into. But it's been around for, you know, a very, very long time, but now just becoming a lot more popularized with the tools we now have to measure it.
I love that. So let's just start super basic. What is biological age and what is chronological age?
Yeah, love to start here at the basics. It's absolutely fundamental to understand where this conversation is going to evolve and grow. But biological age, well, let me start with chronological age, actually. Chronological age is, you know, the number of candles you're blowing off your cake, or, you know, whatever you're going to have presented at your birthday party in terms of a treat. It's going to be what's on your birth certificate. So really physically how many years you've been alive on this planet. We know, though, that that is not a good predictor of health, hence the need for some type of other metric. And this is where biological age comes in, which is really the age of how you are on a cellular level. And just a good example of how to compare the two, you know, you can take people who are 45 years old, right? And some of them look like they're, you know, 65 or older. Some of them look like they're 25 or younger. So that's what the biological age is really describing.
I love it. I love that we have so much power over these numbers. So that's amazing. Thank you for that. Okay. Now, True Diagnostics, biological age, how do you guys come to that number?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And as I mentioned, there are a lot of ways to measure the biological aging process. So I think maybe giving a little bit of history about that would be super helpful just for the listeners who may not be as familiar. But even years, I mean, hundreds, thousands of years ago, they used kind of smoking status as a way to detect your biological age, which is a really crude measurement, right? But we know smoking is not good for our health. So if you smoked more, your biological age would be higher. And there are a lot of other ways to measure that. You know, there's telomere length testing. There's testing where you can measure, you know, glycans or even blood-based value measurements for biological age as well. But True Diagnostic in particular measures epigenetic modifications. And there are also a lot of epigenetic modifications, but in particular, we're measuring DNA methylation. So really just looking at the expression levels of your genes, of your genetic pattern.
Okay, Hannah, can you break down what that means exactly?
Yeah, of course. So the epigenetics, to define that, epi means above. So we're looking on top of your genomic sequence. Epigenetics is going to be changeable, right? Biological age is going to be changeable. Whereas when we talk about this, we usually end up comparing it to something that is known, which is going to be your genetics, right? A lot of people are familiar with genetics. And genetics are really going to be your variants you're getting from mom and dad, 50% from mom, 50% from dad. And those are actually going to be non-changeable. Those are it's that nucleotide sequence, your A's, T's, and C's, and G's that really are the foundation of you. So, you know, genetics, chronological age, is not going to be changeable. Think of genetics as the hardware of your computer. It's fundamental in order for it to process, in order for it to run. But it's, you know, really not going to change. Whereas the software can change or be updated on a computer, and it's teaching and telling that hardware how to run. So essentially, these epigenetic modifications are changing in response to everything, Kayla. And I'm sure we'll talk about, again, some things that have maybe positive and negative effects on the epigenetic modifications, thus your biological age. But even things, in terms of plants and the environment that we surround ourselves in. So, as just kind of an odd example to start out with, people who actually have more green exposure end up having, slower biological aging compared to those who don't have as much. So that's just one example. But again, coming back to answer your question is we're fundamentally looking at the switching on and the switching off of genes. And sometimes that's favorable in some cases, and in others it's not. We want our tumor suppressor genes to be unmethylated and turned on to suppress tumors, where we want our oncogenes or cancer genes to be methylated and turned off.
Okay, so I know that you guys recently upgraded your reports, which is so exciting. Mm-hmm. How do you pronounce the name of the new report?
Yeah, you're probably referring to that omic MH, I'm assuming. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. So on the past report, really quick, you used to have intrinsic and extrinsic aging. And those numbers, I review a lot of these labs, especially with our executive health patients, and they can be vastly different. So can you talk about what you were looking for the intrinsic age and the extrinsic age?
Yes. Thank you for bringing this point up. I'm so appreciative of you. This is super, super important when looking at any epigenetic test and what they kind of have to offer, because first and foremost, as a company, we're always going to grow. We're going to find the best biomarkers. That's our end goal. And the intrinsic and extrinsic were that at one time, but they are what we define as first generational clocks. So these clocks were created back in 2011, 2013-ish, and really were started by Dr. Steve Horvath out of UCLA with one goal in mind, which was to predict chronological age by looking at DNA methylation markers and epigenetics. And the intrinsic and the extrinsic are examples of that. So they're trying to get closer and closer to chronological age without using any underlying biological information and data. When we had those, we knew they were better at predicting all-cause mortality and morbidity compared to just chronological age alone. So we were able to use those. And those still have really great application to identify the age of DNA at crime scenes per se, or to see if refugees are old enough to seek asylum. We were just featured recently in a crazy documentary series, if you've seen it, which is The Curious Case of Natalia Grace, to identify her actual true chronological age. So it does have its application. So that is the process by which we really created the intrinsic and the extrinsic epigenetic age algorithm.
Well, thank you so much for that. Okay, yeah. So now I'm looking at a lab. I'm looking at a true diagnostic test, and there's so much to go over, and I'm so excited to talk about all of this. So mm-hmm. with the new reporting, so we have the calendar age and the biological age. So, obviously chronological versus biological. And then you're given a number. Mm-hmm. So essentially you are given your biological age, which is amazing. Next, we have basically a breakdown of where you rank versus everyone else that's taken this test, which is amazing. And then we have your risk of disease. So can you mm-hmm. talk about, so as I'm looking at this report, it's, there's a risk of cancer, there's a risk of heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, COPD, and depression. So talk to me about how you guys, break these down and how you guys have these assessments.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. And Kayla, first, I think I want to differentiate, again, the intrinsic and extrinsic versus the new omic MH. If I can add more to the yeah. last question too, that omic MH is going to be considered the best biological age clock ever created to date, period. And best is very subjective, but what I mean by that is it is the most predictive of outcomes. And again, that is what's really useful in terms of using these clocks in a clinical setting, because they have to change that clinical decision-making, or at least add value to it, right? So that omic MH is considered a second generation clock, which means we powered it with more underlying biological data in the creation of the algorithm. So we measured 27,000 untargeted proteins, 8,500 metabolites, 61 clinical lab values and variables, and then about 1 million DNA methylation markers to really come up with again, the most predictive, the most correlated to outcomes, adding personalized guidance as to how and why you're aging, controlling for immune cell subsets. It's also going to be the most correlated with some other epigenetic clocks as well that are most related of quality of life-based metrics, for example. So this omic MH is really, you know, first in class, and I love that we're going over it today. And how we trained it, like you mentioned, we used a Harvard data set and cohort. So that was our partner in the study. And we were able to then predict relative risk. So it's not, you know, an absolute risk where you may walk outside and, you know, for lack of a better example, get struck by lightning or hit by a car. It's a relative risk compared to the rest of the population who have your same chronological age, which is based on, again, the omic M aging. So it's a risk, a relative risk based on how you're aging, essentially.
Interesting. Okay. Well, that definitely clarifies things, mm-hmm. things quite a bit. Okay. Next, we have the epigenetic biomarker proxies driving your biological age. And, you know, I'll send a link to one of these tests because I'm launching a subscription and I'm going to put out all of my personal protocols. So I've been doing super comprehensive lab testing, full body MRIs, Clearly AI, soft plaque analysis, all of these things for many years now. And I'm getting ready to launch a subscription. I will have my biological age data in there, the whole nine yards. So I will be putting this out, you know, just for everybody to see. Even before having a subscription, you're going to be able to see all of my labs. So I'm very excited about that. Because to be honest, Yana, you know, it's great to chat with you. There's not really a lot of women in this field. That's why it's so nice to chat with you, and we'll have to continue to develop our friendship. But, most of the studies aren't done on women.
Yeah, correct. And that's why I'm so glad that you're add me to that subscription or wherever I can view what you're doing. Because there's a huge need for that. You see a lot of other players in the space, that again are mostly men. And that's great. We need the data, but, you know, women are not men. We are completely different, from a biological makeup. So the need for any type of those kind of even N1 precision-based studies like you're performing and making everything available publicly is amazing. So count me in, sign me up for sure.
Yes, I'll definitely let you know when it's live. It's really exciting. There's so much data to sort through. I have like a small team right now, not only working on pulling all of my past data, but also just pulling basically like every study that's actually done on women into like one centralized place. So I'm so excited. But okay, so going on to the epigenetic biomarker proxies driving your biological age. So I see some lab values here. We see BUN, glucose, we see triglyceride, HbA1c, and then essentially it's giving a score as to whether or not this lab value is raising, like increasing or decreasing your, I believe, biological age here. Can you break this down for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is what's really revolutionary about the omic MH is I just kind of named off the 1,000 biomarkers we measured in the creation of the omic MH itself. And with that, we are then able to basically ask the machine learning or ask the algorithm, hey, which values are most predictive and statistically significant of the omic MH. And those were kind of those, it's between like 32 to 38 of them are listed on the report, were selected. So those are the ones that we need to target in order to lower that omic MH. And this is what we call, like you stated, Kayla, an EBP or an epigenetic biomarker proxy. So this is a surrogate marker. It's completely different from what you would get from a laboratory value, such as, you know, a CBC panel or, you know, a metabolomic panel or a proteomic panel. But in the future, these will absolutely act as replacements, which is amazing because it's going to keep cost pretty low. It's going to keep the sample collection at a minimum and, you know, the turnaround time being super quick with all of your outcomes being delivered at once. So I'm not sure if you're looking at the bar graph part of the report, or I would scroll mm-hmm. down to kind of the expanded version where you can see what percentile you're in, because there are some EBPs that you want higher. And there are some EBPs that, you know, you want lower. So, you know, for example, you mentioned BUN, the blood urea nitrogen, you want to decrease that outcome. That is bad for omic MH. So we want to take some measurements to be able to decrease that. Whereas, you know, hemoglobin and hematocrit, for example, are good for omic MH. Those are values that we would want to increase. So you can kind of see where you're at in the percentile and increase things that are maybe a little bit lower and decrease things that are maybe a little bit higher.
I mean, this is just an idea, but people love to see, you know, OCRs, like the optimal clinical outcome range. And if you know what the goal is here, I mean, that would be something great for you guys to put out at True Diagnostics, because we know that, you know, standard lab values are just not cutting it. I mean, this is not, I do not benchmark myself against standard lab values. I benchmark myself against optimal female lab value outcomes, right? So that's really exciting, because if we have more information on what it takes in order to improve your biological age, then there are so many different modalities and lifestyle changes that you can do to impact specific numbers, right?
Exactly. And I think we're learning more and more about what that maybe even optimal range looks like in terms of the epigenetic proxies, the biomarker proxies. Because something that's super interesting about True Diagnostic too is we have an extremely, and I mean extremely healthy cohort. I mean, they're patients that, you know, it's yourself, Kayla, right? It's people like you, it's people who you're seeing in your clinic on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, most people, I don't know if anyone agrees with me on this, but I'm a very competitive person, right? I want to be compared against the best. I want to be able to, you know, strive for greatness and really dig into the details in terms of what, you know, what do I need to do from a lifestyle level? Are there, you know, supplements, medications, any procedural based therapies that are really going to push me past that mark and, you know, really have me at my optimal level of health.
I love that. And we're going to definitely get into what we can do, but I want to finish kind of like just the base of this test. So we have the clinical epigenetic biomarker proxies, and then we have metabolite epigenetic biomarker proxies. Can you explain them what that means?
Yeah. So those metabolite biomarker proxies are just going to be like the clinical lab values, but for metabolites. So we measured about 8,500 metabolites for the overall omic MH. And, you know, people may be a little bit more unfamiliar with the metabolites and with the proteomic values that we will go over with. But these are pretty simple. So a metabolite is going to be any substance that's going to be produced, you know, during metabolism. It's kind of a byproduct, right? So whether you're going through digestion or some other bodily chemical process, and the term metabolite may also refer to the product that remains after like a medicine or, you know, again, chemical is broken down or metabolized by the body. So a couple examples of these, you know, are even going to be like antibiotics and, you know, other pigments as well. So these can be catalyzed by various enzymes that occur naturally within the cell. So that's what we're really talking about when we're talking about metabolites, but they're just the interpreted version from the DNA methylation and the epigenetic data.
So are more metabolites better or less metabolites better, or it depends on the actual biomarker?
Yeah, it would depend. So I'll give you a good example. One good example I always use when I'm picking a metabolites, maybe my favorite that the omic MH selected, it's going to be the carotene 3-3 diol. If you're looking at the report, it's the first one on the right column. This is one of the 600 known naturally occurring carotenoids. It's synthesized really only by plants, and it's found in high quantities in green leafy veggies like spinach, kale, and yellow carrots. It's why you hear people say, hey, eat more carrots, you'll have better eyesight. So we know that this carotenoid can help improve cognitive function and eye health. So for example, this metabolite in particular would be good for omic MH. We want more of this, and we can do it through, you know, specific dietary choices, or we can even do it through lutein supplementation as well.
Good. I love that. I eat a lot of carrot sauerkraut, so...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. So then we have your protein epigenetic biomarker proxies. Break this down for us.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So the same exact thing. And this is going to be where we measured about 27,000 untargeted proteins in the body. So it was like a non-specific analysis. But again, this is really going to depend on whether you want, you know, more or less, this is going to depend on the actual protein itself. But this shouldn't be anything that's unfamiliar to those listening. So just some simple examples of proteins include even things like, you know, keratin, collagen, elastin. Those in particular are some fibrous proteins that I just named that are usually in the cells and tissues of our body that help with, you know, stiffness and the rigidity, the kind of cellular structure that we have. So there's another, probably one of mine that's my favorite, and this is going to be, I think it's on the top, the first one in the left-hand column. It's going to be the serum peroxidase or the PON1 protein. And we call it the PON1 because the serum peroxidase is an enzyme encoded by this PON1 gene. And this PON1 is usually secreted by the liver, although it's synthesized in different tissues. It's really found in almost all tissues, and it's a very major anti-atherosclerotic component of HDL cholesterol, so that good cholesterol that you want. So this is actually, again, good for omic MH. We want to increase this marker. Some studies have even shown, for this one in particular, if a person has different levels of PON1, and this PON1 activity can be impaired, or if you don't have enough, that could be an indicator of inflammation, higher risk for even things like cardiometabolic disease and some outcomes like that. So we can increase that in a multitude of ways. Pomegranate consumption are known for their antioxidant content, which can enhance this PON1 activity, or even chokeberry extract, again, rich in antioxidants. So that's kind of a different one there, or even like selenium-rich foods, or, Brazil nuts, seafood, whole grains, selenium being that, again, trace mineral, all leading back to kind of this antioxidant pathway, or even reducing trans fat intake as well. No processed foods that could negatively impact the PON1.
In general, if you're listening to this, please do not be eating processed foods. This is, if you're eating processed foods, I hate to say it, but I don't know if it's worth your time right now to do your biological age, because you absolutely have to, cover the bases first. So, and we'll I'm so excited because I know that lifestyle factors, you and I chatted about this before, are really the biggest impact. And then there's all these, let's just say, like biohacking, health optimization therapies that we'll go into. But next in the test is everybody's favorite, and that's the pace of aging. So that's what you guys are using in the Rejuvenation Olympics. That's, all the big headlines is how to slow the pace of aging. So just talk about it a little bit, how you guys come up with this value.
Yeah, the gene and pace is still, I think, probably my favorite to talk about. So this is what's going to be considered a third generation clock. So we already reviewed, first generation clocks is an older technology. Second generation, they're going to be more predictive of, mortality and morbidity, and more of kind of this historical based biological aging process, where the third generation is very unique in how it was created. And it was created really over a 50-year longitudinal trial in Dunedin, New Zealand, that's still going on today. And that was started in 1972 and 1973 with about 1,000 New Zealanders, again, from Dunedin, where they basically studied them across their entire lifetime and took biomarkers and obviously blood-based samples, where we could go back and look at the DNA methylation changes at those times. So it is not going to come out as an age equivalent. It's going to come out as more of a rate. So it can go from 0.6 to 1.4. If you're at that one marker kind of in the middle there, you'd be aging one biological year for every one chronological year. So the goal is to be as low as possible. This is more, again, of a current kind of lifestyle reflection. It's more of a 3 to 6 month running average. You're exactly right. We're using this in the Rejuvenation Olympics right now because as of right now, I still believe, and according to, the research, the data, and the science, it is really the best clock for the N of 1 precision-based medicine because it is so precise, you can really retest it every 2 to 3 weeks. Whereas with that omic MH, it's so new, we're still testing it out, but we probably wouldn't recommend testing it any sooner than 6 months. And just the way that the Dunedin paste has been, again, validated in a lot of peer-reviewed external published trials, you know, says a lot about its ability to measure and pick up change.
I love that. So you are saying about every 3 to 6 months, you could see lifestyle changes reflected in this number.
Oh, absolutely. Even within, you know, 2 months, within 8 weeks. So we just released pretty controversial. We can get into it later. We don't have to talk about the details now, but the You Are What You Eat documentary with our collaborators at Stanford, where it was the vegan versus omnivore diet. And we were able to pick up even changes with the Dunedin paste over that 8 week period. So I think we'll learn more, but it is pretty quick to pick up, you know, any interventional or procedural based changes you're going to make.
I love that. So I watched a portion of that documentary. So what was the overall outcome? Like, I do remember their results. Was it vegan or was it carnivore? What was their recommendation?
Yeah. So the vegan diet group showed significant decreases, just in overall epigenetic age acceleration. So, you know, some of the second generation clocks and the Dunedin paste, as well as in some of our kind of organ system based clocks as well. But I would say, you know, it's super important and crucial to even stress that, you know, vegan diets still, I would say, lack, you know, essential nutrients for optimal epigenetic processes over probably a longer period of time. So, you know, you need to make sure you're obviously consulting with providers and, you know, supplementing properly as well, so you don't have any type of risk of long-term damage. So, you know, as scientists, we really want to make sure that we're communicating that message clearly and empathetically, ensuring that the public's super well-informed about, you know, their dietary choices and how that impacts their overall health. So it was really just scratching the surface, kind of seeing the differences, and hopefully people will do some more follow-up studies with it as well.
Yeah, I think that's what's really needed is the longer term, because I remember watching that and I was interested to basically just know what the outcome was going to be. Like, are they going to say vegan or, you know, more of an, you know, vegan or meat? So this is the question I always have. And I think about this a lot when I'm looking at patient data, right? So we have so many factors that actually equate to optimal health. So biological age, of course, is one of them, and the pace of aging is one of them. But then let's just say, as an example, we know that you have to put on, you know, as much muscle, essentially, not bodybuilder status, but you need to have a substantial amount of muscle as early as possible, because we know that, you know, especially for women, you know, falling down, breaking a hip, not having the muscle mass, and sarcopenia setting in. So how do we find the balance of, and I don't know if you'll have this full answer right now, but essentially what I'm getting at is we have biological age, and if we know the biomarkers that can influence that biological age, but then we also have other health outcomes that we have to ensure that we hit in order to be, you know, healthy 40, 50, 60 years down the road. It's interesting because I guess we just need more data on it, right? Because if they're saying vegan diet had the most significant biological age changes, which I believe completely, and we also know, right, that caloric restriction is the only thing that is really shown to have a substantial impact on life extension. But if you're calorically restricting, then it can have a negative impact, let's just say, on hormones or, you know, other areas of health. So I guess I went on this little rant just to get your opinion on that.
I love it. No, it's such a great point. It's super, super hard. And aging is extremely, you know, multifactorial. It's super complex. A couple years ago, you know, we just had kind of 9 hallmarks of aging in 2013. Now we have like 12 or 14. So there's more and more complexity, right, as time goes on. And it seems as we keep having more questions than answers, which is, you know, always a good problem to have. But it still does have to be a balance. I'll you know, tell you a statistic about the omic MH, and again, why it's the one I would prioritize out of any outcomes that we offer. So the omic MH, this isn't something we put on the reports, but it actually can predict death with a 92% accuracy rate compared to chronological age, which can only predict it with a 72% accuracy rate. So really leaning on, again, these biological age clocks because of their predictive capabilities, I think is still key. But you have to be able to, again, make the correct lifestyle choices for you right now, depending on what your goals are. So caloric restriction is a good example where there's a calorie randomized control trial. It was published a year ago in Nature. And it basically looked at, they started out with 25% caloric restriction, but realized people couldn't do that. So they went down to about a 10% overall caloric restriction in healthy non-obese adults over a 2-year period. And really when they compared all of the clocks head to head at the time, first generation clocks went up with caloric restriction, which doesn't make much sense. Second generation clocks decreased a little bit, but still it was looking off. The data didn't make much sense. And they really, really saw a decrease in the Dunedin pace, which is great. What does that mean? Well, like you said, Kayla, caloric restriction has been identified in a ton of animal models, Theligans, Drosophila, mice, rat models, to extend lifespan. We can't do that in humans right away. It's obviously very unethical. So we have to use these clocks as a way to see if caloric restriction is changing them in a decrease, right? In a way that's actually favorable. And the Dunedin pace did that. It was the only clock to be able to do that. So I think that, you know, goes to show the Dunedin pace is extremely valuable as well, but you also have to weigh, you know, obviously if you're pregnant, breastfeeding, working on hormones, trying to, again, meet some type of muscle mass or right athletic based goal, you're going to probably want to intake more calories, and caloric restriction wouldn't be recommended in that situation. So it's hard. I don't know that I have a definitive answer for you either.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just something that I'm working through a lot because with the popularity of these biomarkers, everybody wants to have, especially the types of patients that I'm consulting on a daily basis, they want to have an incredible decrease in that age, but it's walking that, and for myself too, right? It's walking that balance of impacting these numbers while also ensuring that you're hitting major milestones that you have to be concerned with in terms of overall health, optimization, and longevity. So it's interesting, and I can't wait. You know, the whole protocol in general is so new, right? I mean, we know someone that is the most, you know, popular for this, and it's very new. It's in the past couple of years. And then I looked at myself and I'm like, I've been doing all this stuff for so long and my outcomes are amazing right now. So why am I not sharing it? So now I'm getting ready to do that. But
yeah,
I'm excited to see my pace, my newest pace of aging. And I've done all the tests, and that's another thing. We don't have to go into it on this podcast, but I've done the glycan age. I've done biomes age. I've done inside track. I've done all these different tests. Obviously we now know that True Diagnostic is like the gold standard in this testing, but it's interesting that everyone is looking at a different metric, because you get all these different numbers, right?
Right, right. Yeah, I think, again, just from like a longitudinal standpoint, if you do choose, you know, a company or you're measuring your biological age, you know, just stick with it, right? You may want to look at kind of precision-based outcomes. And again, something we don't have to get into. But you're right. It's kind of how does, you know, one clock correlate with the other? What do we see in terms of changes here and there? But I think what you're doing in terms of making everything public and just, you know, people being able to ask questions and really dive into it and encouraging this type of sharing is especially needed in this space. So I'm just super appreciative that, yeah, you're putting yourself out there and, you know, being transparent about it as well.
No, I'm so excited because they, like I said, it's so multifactorial, right? Like we can look at biological age, amazing metric. I mean, I'm definitely going to be kind of like recalibrating to go back to that. But then we also have like toxic burden that a lot of people are not looking at. Mm-hmm. We also have gut health. Like what are those numbers? You know, so I have like literally the best gut test we've ever seen, the best total toxin test. So it's like, it's really, I'm excited to continue to analyze my own data and just figure out like what is the perfect balance that you can optimize toxins, gut, body composition, general like lab markers in the optimal range and pace of aging. So it's so much fun. I'm just having a blast looking at everything.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you're pulling all of these strings, right? And trying to make, you know, really be on a level of mental clarity, you know, at your physical peak, kind of checking all of those boxes. So it is interesting. And I'm obviously obsessed with epigenetics. I say this a lot. So I will be the first to tell you that, hey, you have to get your biological age testing. The more data, the better, right? The more power you have, that's, you know, more knowledge, only knowledge you can really gain from understanding your own body. But I will also be the first to tell you that you still need to do genetic testing, right? You still need to do CBC panels, hormone-based testing, the gut testing, you know, looking at your microbiome and using it all synergistically, because again, there isn't kind of this end all be all one test. And I don't know that we'll ever see it. I think you need, you know, multiple opinions, multiple outcomes, and seeing again how those are related to outcomes. That's really the end goal. But something I'll also say is epigenetics does look to be in first place, really, for being causative as to why we're mm-hmm. aging. And I think that's important to bring up, because right now it's all correlation, right? We know that people who have faster biological aging are more likely to, you know, become sick or, mm-hmm. you know, have an increased risk of all-cause mortality, morbidity. But it's not causation quite yet. It's getting very, very close. There's some pretty cool papers that have been released on that more recently from Albert Ying or Kajian out of Harvard University, who created more of these kind of causal epigenetic age clocks called DAM age for damage and adapt age for more adaptation. So if anyone, you know, is interested in learning more, you can, you know, Google him and look him up. But it's starting to move in that direction. And I don't think any other kind of biomarker in terms of, you know, proteins or metabolites or anything like that is.
I love that. That's amazing. Okay. So that's the pace of aging. Goal is here. Slow it as much as you can. So that's, I love that. Mm-hmm. Then it's, I mean, you know, my audience is primarily female, about 80% female. So then next we have, and again, I'll be putting all this stuff out, my own results, once I get my new test results. Hannah, if you have any pull on expediting it, that would be great. I sent it in today. Then we have the face of aging. So, I mean, obviously, I know you guys can't see this, but obviously we have a very youthful looking woman, you know, to a not so youthful looking woman. So it's good to know, right, that if we slow the pace of aging, it's going to slow the pace of aging across the board. Skin health, mm-hmm. internal health, the whole nine yards. Great. We love that. All right. So now we're getting into immune health. And mm-hmm. it looks like, again, we have some markers here. So can you break this down for us, the immune health? Because we know, obviously, immunosenescence is one of the big hallmark pillars of aging.
Yeah. So this is where epigenetics and DNA methylation testing that we do is really disrupting a $6 billion industry. So I don't know, Kayla, if you ever do any like flow cytometry or cell sorting testing. There's a panel from UCLA that you can get that, you know, some kind of functional providers may do. But again, it's a couple thousand bucks. It's a logistical nightmare. It's a large plasma sample and you ship it on dry ice. So it's a headache, to be quite honest. And we can actually do that same type of testing through the DNA methylation and epigenetics. And that's what you're seeing there. So we published this in Genome Medicine with Harvard, Johns Hopkins, and Chinese Academy of Sciences. And it's really utilizing DNA methylation profiles to construct a 12-cell immune deconvolution method. And while we can do this in a very accurate way, I would say clinically speaking, Kayla, what you probably want to focus on the most is where you see the CD4, CD8 T-cell ratio information. That's where we're going to give a little bit more of a description. And the CD4, CD8 T-cell ratio is just a really good marker of overall immune health. And you want this marker to be between 1 and 4. If it's above 4, you're going to be a little bit hyperreactive. giving you more phenotypic outwards expressions of like an autoimmune disease or disorder. But if you are going to be lower than one, between zero and one, it's going to mean the opposite, meaning that you're going to be immunosuppressed. And we may, you know, recommend some immune modulation support therapy, like vitamin D, zinc. You know, there are some other peptides out there as well that can help regenerate the thymus for better immune system, thymic aging. But we're really aiming to be between one and four. Probably optimal, you would want to be like 2 to 2.5, I would say.
Thank you for giving us a very specific number to aim for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
Okay, quick detour then, because we brought up peptides. I've used peptides on and off, I mean, for like 7+ years. What peptides are you seeing actually have an impact on biological age or pace of aging?
Yeah. Oh, I would say, you know, love peptides definitely was here when it was, really peaking in terms of its use. Just unfortunately, I would say we don't gather much data or information about them, just with them not being around as often. So I would say, maybe, you know, I would say, yeah, we just don't see it as much anymore, Kayla, unfortunately, but to, really help with the CD4-CD8 T-cell ratio. A lot of people are doing like the growth hormone secretagogues, like the CJC-1295 ipamorelin or samorelin, to help regenerate the thymus for better immune system thymic aging. So that's going to be, you know, a pretty good one. There's also, you know, thymus and alpha-1, I would say. That was probably a lot of people's favorites, and in mine in particular. You know, I think everyone should probably be on it. It's, you know, a naturally just kind of occurring peptide again in the thymus that has been really recognized in a ton of different peer-reviewed published papers for modifying, enhancing, restoring immune function. That one would probably be really great here as well. It's just a lot harder to get your hands on, but really has an effective use in a, you know, myriad of diseases too, ranging from, you know, immune deficiencies, cancers, all sorts of different things.
Yeah, I love that peptide. And we won't get into it, but long story short, peptides were very readily available at compounding pharmacies across, you know, the nation for clinics like the one I own, and we would, you know, see great outcomes, right? And recently the FDA decided to use their time to go after these small compounding pharmacies and make peptides very difficult, you know, if not impossible to get. There's a whole variety of them are no longer available, essentially. So, I mean, if anyone's asking my opinion, I think they have way bigger things to be focused on. Like maybe, I don't know, getting all the poison out of our food system instead of being concerned about the fact that, you know, a couple compounding pharmacies are making peptides that are naturally occurring amino acids and proteins. I mean, it's total disaster. I mean, the FDA.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's unfortunate too. And that's how I definitely got my start in this space, was working at one of those compounding pharmacies and just seeing really, you know, how these were changing people's lives. So some of the compounding pharmacies, you know, can't even really compound stevia because they can only do things that are FDA approved, which is not the definition of a compounding pharmacy. So it's super, super frustrating and really affected, you know, many people's lives.
Yeah, I mean, no one can forget that they tried to take away quercetin, right? During, you know, we won't even call it, during the time period that was recent, and they try to take quercetin out. I mean, that you're not allowed to get that. I mean, they don't want you to have NAD. It's just so frustrating. It's just like, focus on the things that are actually like killing people, in my opinion, because people have to spend so much time and effort and money to have healthy food when they could just start, I don't know, banning like so many of the different compounds that are allowed in food. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed.
No, I'm sure that you do. I'm sure that you do. Okay. So then we have other immunosenescent ratios going back to the lab. Any major points to talk about there?
Yeah, not necessarily, I would say, in terms of clinical relevancy. So sticking to that CD4-CD8 T-cell ratio, we're kind of just listing them there because we can report out on them, but probably something I wouldn't pay too much attention to.
Okay, next we have telomere length. I mean, this used to be, I feel like, you know, the exciting thing. So can you tell us what telomeres are and how you guys are essentially measuring telomere length for your test?
Yeah, absolutely. So these telomeres are probably what most people are familiar with, even when they hear biological age-based testing. So at one point, it was definitely considered the gold standard. But basically, a telomere is just a region of repetitive DNA sequences at the end of a chromosome. And these usually protect the ends of the chromosomes from becoming frayed or tangled. People think of them like a frayed shoelace. Sometimes, and each time your cell divides, the telomeres become shorter and shorter and shorter. And you know, eventually they become so short, the cell can no longer divide successfully and the cell is going to die. So that's just kind of a brief overview of telomeres. And they are, again, a biological age predictor, but a very poor biological age predictor. So we still choose to report them out because we believe they may be able to be a measurement of kind of your senescence, your senolytic cell status. And I can explain that here in a second. But again, the telomeres are definitely one we want to prioritize the least. We're still measuring them, though, through epigenetic interpretation, where you can get, you know, a quantitative PCR test or a FISH, the fluorescence in situ hybridization test for telomeres. Mm-hmm. That's even, you know, around the same cost or more expensive. And the DNA methylation, what we're doing is going to be more correlated to age-related outcomes by about 2.5 times than your quantitative PCR. But nothing's going to get as good as that fluorescence in situ hybridization. The reason, though, I say it can be a senolytic cell check-in is because we kind of want to look at what percentile you're in. And if you're in the 20th percentile or lower, because remember, we want more telomeres, we want them long, you probably have some type of senolytic, phenotype. You have more senescent cells, and that's where those shorter telomeres are living. So that's where we may recommend a senolytic therapy, whether you're doing, fisetin, quercetin, I know you just talked about, or any other type of antioxidant therapies too. So, you know, more recently, there's the kind of antioxidant paradox where, you know, too much is probably not helpful, where, you know, we're producing all of these kind of antioxidants and too many can be more negative for our health. So we want to make sure that we're able to balance it and measure it to some extent. And we believe we can do it with the telomere outcome.
Great. I love that. Some of the things that I was most excited about when it comes to telomere extension, there's some studies, you know, that back hyperbaric oxygen therapy for lengthening telomeres, which is really cool. And we actually offer them at my clinic and I've done them a few times. So I need to definitely start doing like a biological and telomere test before and after I do some of these therapies. So like V cells, that, you know, is supposed to have a really great impact on that and in general biological age. Okay, so we're getting near the end of the test. And then we're going to go into all the things that are going to help to decrease biological age. The fit age test. So is that looking at anything new or is it also looking at methylation?
So, yeah, everything you see on there is methylation. So that DNA methylation fit age. So again, this comes out as a biological age score. And this is where it gets a little bit more fun and kind of gamified. It's like a characteristic or trait-based report where it's based off of an algorithm that was actually created out of UCLA by someone named Kristen McGreevy. She's awesome, super young and you know, really health-driven, passionate for these type of biomarkers. And it includes the omic MH in its calculation, but it also is going to actually include epigenetic biomarker proxies of VO2 max, gait speed, grip strength, and FEV1. So we even give you, you know, really where you are in terms of those markers. So, you know, if you're in a lower percentile for any of them, say, for example, you're in a lower percentile for your grip strength, we may recommend, you know, anaerobic-based exercises like weightlifting to help your grip strength increase. Or for, you know, VO2 max or FEV1, if those look a little bit lower, we may do some aerobic-based exercises. Those aerobic-based exercises can be more like distance-focused almost, if you want to think about it that way. Like, you know, swimming, running, cycling, hiking, things like that. It's going to be less kind of hit, more endurance based.
What is the FEV1 epigenetic biomarker proxy?
Yeah, so FEV1 is going to be that forced expiratory volume one. So this is previously been used as a measurement to stage certain lung conditions like COPD and asthma. It basically indicates how much air you can exhale in 1 second. So a low FEV kind of implies that airflow is obstructed. And you can use, again, this ratio for different like lung diseases and disorders to help form a type of diagnosis. So it's going to be correlated with VO2 max in a sense. Swimmers as a good example, have like an awesome FEV1 kind of that breath out that they're able to take.
I love that.
If you've ever had maybe Kayla, ever measured it with a spirometer too. If you ever see those, some people would do that like with the grip strength machines at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually just ordered a grip strength machine to keep at home, to like sync in with all my data. So, and I've done a spirometer in the past as well. So these are going to become more, common in my life as I'm continuing to like refine these protocols. Okay. So next we have information on smoking, and obviously if you're a non-smoker, that's the best route. Alcohol consumption. Then there's some weight loss response. I want to get through the rest of this. And then we have the intrinsic and extrinsic age. So it is still on this test. That's great. It's just moved down. Mm-hmm. And that's it. So we already went over that. Okay. So now let's talk about the fun stuff. What are people doing? So you guys obviously have the most data on, biological age reversal, slowing age, because you guys have all the information. So Rejuvenation Olympics, and it's also important to say not everyone that even maybe has the best results is in the Rejuvenation Olympics, right? That's like people that want to, and they're excited about that. So we've talked about this before, lifestyle, biggest impact, right?
Yep, absolutely. I've reviewed so many of these reports, at least from a true diagnostic standpoint. I've done thousands. And the people who, again, are just doing the lifestyle factors correct, they're living that, quote unquote, simple life where it's, a balance of nutrition, stress, sleep, physical activity. Those are definitely the main four. But like you said, there's so much more that goes into it, whether it's detoxifying, right? Working on your insulin sensitivity. Whether it's, we don't like to use BMI as kind of a measurement, but since it was previously used as a measurement, it's what we have in a lot of the biobanks. So even keeping like a really healthy weight is going to be kind of related to that biological age outcome. And there may be a couple more lifestyle factors that I may be forgetting as well. Like you mentioned, just like not smoking, right? Drinking any alcohol whatsoever. I think some previous studies pointed to maybe, one glass of wine a week or, a can of beer, but yeah.
It's so annoying. I mean, this is so crazy, like how hard we have tried to like back alcohol with science. It's a neurotoxin. It's not healthy. If you have an Oura Ring and you look at one night of data and you see that your readiness score is half, your sleep is wrecked, there's nothing good about it. And no one can convince me, and there's no study that can convince me that having alcohol is healthy. I don't drink. My husband doesn't drink. And I mean, maybe like half a glass of red wine in the past, like 1.5 years, but it did absolutely nothing for me. So I think I'm just not going to have any moving forward. It just, I don't know. Yeah. I really don't know how people do it. I don't know how people drink every day. I don't know. I would feel awful, and I have no time for that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah. And that's the point too, is like not, having no time for it. Right. Because what happens is, of course, you drink alcohol, right? You wake up, you're hungover, you want to eat something that's going to be unhealthy. You're going to be stressed out. You're going to have that increased heart rate. You're not going to get your work done. It's just this kind of, even talking about it gives me a little bit of anxiety. It's this downwards kind of cascading level of events that happens and unfolds.
No, I would just call it an absolute disaster, to be honest.
It is.
I think the broader question is why are you doing that, right? That's a whole nother conversation, but why do you feel, I feel zero social pressure to have alcohol. And if you do, then you have to like ask yourself, why do I feel like, I need to be drinking to be interesting, or why do I need to be drinking to make conversation or to feel, you know, it, that's a whole nother conversation, but I totally agree. Okay. So when it comes to diet, obviously you guys saw the vegan versus, you know, you know, meat eating diets. So in the general terms, is that how all the data looks across the board? Like even for longer term, like people that are testing their pace of aging?
Yeah, I would say longer term, we just don't know, to be honest. So we would still recommend more of like what the other studies are going to say, which is, you know, again, really prioritizing whole foods, quality foods, yeah. Right? Mediterranean-based diet, follow kind of what they're doing in those blue zone areas. DASH diet, dietary approaches to stop hypertension. We're doing a study right now with Dr. Jewel Furman on the Nutritarian diet, which is almost like a more strict version of the DASH diet. So we would probably expect even better outcomes as well. But that is going to be what's also referred to as the G-bombs. And that is going to be maybe a little bit harder to follow because it's only greens, beans, onions, mushrooms, berries, and seeds. So it's more of like that true kind of like gatherer type of diet. So we'll see what we find out. And you know, alongside of the caloric restriction, according to, you know, what we know reverses these clocks.
Wait, so the diet you just mentioned, there's no protein, just protein from plant sources.
Yeah, from only plant sources. So we'll see what that looks like. Yeah, where the DASH diet, the dietary, yeah, approaches to stop hypertension is going to be more protein based. But yeah, I'll be interested to see what it says. And again, kind of the protein being that weighing factor.
So is everybody on the top Rejuvenation Olympics right now? Are they all vegan?
I don't know for sure is the definitive answer, but I highly, highly doubt it, I would say.
Good.
Yeah.
All right. Wonderful.
Yeah.
okay. Supplementation. So let's just say lifestyle, we've nailed lifestyle, right? We're getting high quality sleep, 8 hours a night. Aura Ring is just crushing it. Stress management. You have good social circles and you're happy. You're eating an amazing diet, like super nutritious, all whole foods, let's just say that. And you're working out. So all of that is done. What else? What about supplementation? So we know there's NAD, there's NMN, there's spermidine, there's senolytics that are supposed to help kill and really reduce senescent cells. So what are you saying to be moving the needle the most?
Yeah, I think those are all great. I think I'll maybe go like according to what's actually been published and then give you my like, again, subjective information that I'm gathering from all these providers and what I see when I'm interpreting these results. So from just a pure, like, again, literature review, the one that's been shown is going to be vitamin D supplementation, which again is no surprise, 4,000, 6,000 IU daily, and lithium supplementation is showing, you know, starting to show kind of an anti-aging effect. Originally studied in, you know, those with bipolar disorder, and they noticed that once they actually give lithium to these patients in these studies, that their biological age started to reverse as well. So more studies are needed for a more healthier population, I think, to really understand how that's working. But one I may throw on there subjectively that we're super excited about is going to be sulforaphane. And I'm hearing more and more about the sulforaphane. And this is basically going to be a chemical that's made when you're chewing, you know, veggies such as like broccoli, cauliflower, broccoli sprouts. It is a phytochemical, which is basically kind of a category of antioxidants that cancel out free radicals. So free radicals are those, you know, tiny particles that over time they're going to weaken and damage healthy cells. And we're really, you know, probably all very heavily made of these free radicals because they're a result of, you know, pollution, UV rays, food additives, as we were talking about, preservatives. They can happen even naturally in some processes like digestion. But the sulforaphane is really going to help, you know, regulate inflammation and, again, get rid of those free radicals.
Absolutely. And for anyone listening, if you're looking at your labs and you have your vitamin D standard range, it's in my opinion, and you know, the recommendation based on all the research I've done, it needs to be somewhere more around like 70 with like a max of 90. I think that the standard range can be, you know, as little as 30, I believe, which is just not, you're not going to have optimal outcome. So, okay, you talked about, I love all of those. I'm interested to know what the mechanism is of the lithium, because I take it from time to time. And just for clarification, are we talking about like prescription high dose lithium or like really low dose supplementation form of lithium?
Oh yes, super, super slow dose. Yeah. Okay. Or sorry, super, super small dose of, yeah, it could be over the counters, you know, yeah. 1 milligram, you know, daily or something of the sort. So yeah, super small. Yeah, in terms of how the lithium actually works, I don't know, that I'm super familiar, with the, actual process. I just, in terms of the biological mechanism, I still think we're maybe trying to, you know, understand a little bit how it works as it relates to aging itself. But there have just been several cases of the neuroprotective effects of lithium. These have been, you know, in some prospective studies where lithium was used both short term and, you know, long term. But I think we probably need to learn a little bit more how it works with cognitive function. But that's probably the organ system it's actually going to be related to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's well known for like mood support, you know, so you can definitely think, you know, correlation to the brain. So, well, great. I'm trying to think, NAD optimization. Are you guys seeing anything with that?
Yeah, definitely. We're really big fans of NAD. I would say more so, probably the precursors, than, the NAD IVs, just for, the ability to, for the NR and the NMN to actually get more intracellular. And we don't have a preference, I should say, over NR and NMN. I know there's, you know, some people prefer one or the other. I think NR may be a little bit cheaper. I'd probably just recommend NR since we can't really distinguish between the two too much right now. But looks pretty good as it relates to reversal of the biological age clocks. And we just don't have enough, you know, data on NAD. IV is why I say that.
That makes sense. What about some of these longevity, you know, prescriptions such as metformin, rapamycin?
Yeah. We love them both. I would probably say rapamycin a little bit more than the metformin itself. With the rapamycin, you have to be a little bit careful not to just, you know, put your body into immunosuppression overdrive, right? That's what it's going to be FDA approved for, is organ transplant kind of support. It was really made to suppress the immune function a little bit. So it inhibits mTOR. So it's going to inhibit that growth in the body. I would say, you know, probably the dosing that I see most frequently used within the clinics is usually around 6 milligrams, you know, once weekly. Some people fluctuate, some people do it, you know, at lower dosing a couple times a week. I don't know. I don't think there's, you know, one right way to do it. I will say I give it to my big old Bernese mountain dog, Evie. She's adorable. And there's only been, you know, dog studies where it can increase lifespan in dogs by about 30%. So you'll start to see some companies, I would say, do more telemedicine health and prescription for dogs, actually, in the very near future.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I don't have any pets, so it's hard for me to relate to that. But I know people really are super passionate about their animals and want to extend their lifespan too, which I mean, you would just think doing things that are appropriate for humans could also be maybe like the dogs moving, not being overweight, eating healthy food. So who knows? I'm most certainly not an expert on that. Okay. So what else? I'm trying to think, any specifics, like anything just in general stand out for women specifically? I mean, let me take a look at this Rejuvenation Olympics and see if I can.
Yeah.
Looks like there's a lot of men on here. There's a few women.
Yeah.
So is there anything that you're seeing that is really, you know, worth noting?
I think one study in particular that's interesting I'll state, there's, and again, this information is probably rather intuitive, but there's one study out there that combines genetic and epigenetic information. It looks kind of at like the genetic variants that you have, in particular the MTHFR gene, which is going to be, again, a pretty, you know, popular variant people are going to test. So women who actually have the 677cc variant have increased biological aging. Super cool that we can make that connection.
Yeah.
And what they noticed, you know, men who have the 677TT also have accelerated aging. But if you supplement with a methylated cofactor, which we know usually works, like 5-methylfolate or methylcobalamin, you almost see that reversal happen instantaneously. Amazing. So again, makes sense because of those pathways and what we know about them. But they actually didn't see that same reversal for men. but I think it's probably because, they gave them the same dosing. But also important to note that those factors I mentioned are going to be hypermethylators. They're going to add methylation. They're going to shut off particular genes. And we want to balance those out with your flavanols, hypomethylators that are going to express genes or taking away that methylation. So things like your catechins, again, antioxidants, the EGCG that you're going to get from green tea extract would all be some pretty good examples.
I love that. Is it easier to slow your pace of aging if you're older, or is it just equal across the board?
It is harder to slow it if you're older, because it's going to increase ever so slightly as we age chronologically. So yeah, when you're looking at like this rejuvenation Olympics board, Kayla, we take that into account. So yeah, it's going to be more impressive if you're older and you're seeing that type of reversal. But it's also going to be easier to change if it obviously is, you know, higher, right? Because you have kind of more room to improve.
Yeah, I think that's how I meant to ask the question was. Yeah, because, you know, once you're like pretty optimized, you really have to take some, I guess, extreme measures. I know there's some interesting therapies like stem cells, follistatin. I'm actually going down to visit Dr. Khan in a few weeks, and I might be doing some follistatin. I'm going to really, you know, think about it and decide when, but I'm just so excited because obviously I'll have my before and afters. Are there any major like treatments that you see a lot of great benefit on biological or pace of aging?
Yeah, the procedural benefits are pretty interesting, right? What a lot of people want to know as well. You know, all things across the board, such as like the exosomes, the stem cells, the B cells, right? Even things like your hyperbaric oxygen chamber therapy. We just did a study on that with Dr. Jason Saunders from HBOT USA at you know, three different pressures, and we'll publish that very, very soon. Even things like, you know, the plasma apheresis or therapeutic plasma exchange and the TPE. I think that's becoming more popularized as well. But again, I think it's just super, super early. A lot of what you're seeing is like more of the N of one kind of test. Hey, is this working for me? Because even with these populational based studies that we're gathering, those epigenetic markers, and again, why they start to look more causal compared to correlative, it's just because they're so specific to you, right? Where if our mother or grandmother or great grandmother, even generations past that, you know, smoked cigarettes or, you know, ate specific artificial foods and flavorings, we probably have some type of epigenomic imprinting on us that is still capturing that. But yet it's malleable in a way that we can change it to an extent with, you know, these therapies that we're talking about. So what I just described there, that's a whole different phenomenon, and it's super interesting. It's called epigenetic transgenerational inheritance, where, again, we're passing this on through generations, and it's not really being studied. It's not being used even in, like, environmental kind of agencies and, you know, government laws as well. So it's a pretty interesting topic for discussion.
It's so exciting. And, you know, like when I met my husband before we actually got married, I saw all of his labs. I sent him a bunch of labs to do prior just to, you know, to have an understanding. He had a lot of questions that he was interested in, and I was like really interested in health questions. But what's so exciting is, you know, I didn't grow up on a super healthy diet. And so I'm excited because I feel like I'm going to set my children up, you know, to really like the best of my ability. We're going to start having a family. And I'm just like, man, I have worked so hard to try to give you the best epigenetic outcome that I can. And I'm really excited for that.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That was so awesome. Because you do have to think about that, right? Which is, you know, are you really setting up the future generations to come for success or for failure? And literally every decision you make, even, you know, really being in tune with ourselves more like emotionally, like our thoughts and how we speak to ourselves, right? Are you know, responsible for those epigenetic, some epigenetic modifications and changes.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I'm so excited about, you know, the mind-body connection. It's already obviously been well established, but it feels like it's becoming more common and, you know, just like bioenergetic medicine and the whole nine yards. So I'm so excited for that. I mean, I could talk to you about this stuff for so long because I love it and as do you, but this has been such a pleasure. We'll have to get back on, you know, just as new updates come to light, new therapies, new like lifestyle habits, because I think it's like, it's really important to just give people this information.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate you for, you know, even having me on here. The more we talk about it, right, the more people are going to get informed and, you know, take hopefully this deep dive into their own health as we both are. So, super appreciative, that you're, you know, bringing light upon the subject.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's been so much fun. And I will, you know, I'll include all the information on the Rejuvenation Olympics, where to get the test. It's the easiest test. I've taken so many labs. It's so easy. It's a blood spot. You can send it in. You know, it's so easy. So thank you also for making it easy because so many tests are like so complicated.
Yeah, of course. I understand the pain there.
Yeah. All right. Well, Hannah, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you again for coming on, and I will talk to you soon.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Kayla.
Hacking was created and is hosted by Kayla Barnes. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and views expressed on this podcast are not medical advice. This podcast, including Kayla Barnes, does not accept responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of the information contained herein. Opinions of their guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. If you think you have a medical issue, consult a licensed physician.